Good afternoon and welcome to Midwest Beat. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. This program is all about music, the arts, and the people who make it. Today I've got two authors on. One will be joining us by phone in just a few, and coming up a little later in the afternoon, we've got Louis Dybel. He is a Northwest Indiana resident, and he has spent many years on the Gold Coast in the hospitality business. And sometimes when you're in the hospitality business, you run into some famous names. We're going to talk about his book, 20 Years on the Gold Coast. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll be playing some of the artists that he's met, too. But sooner than later, we've got Kristen Casey. She is the former girlfriend of Joe Walsh. And she's got a book out about her relationship with Joe over the years, and I'm sure it's going to be colorful. It's all coming up after this. Thank you for tuning in to 89.1 FM Lakeshore Public Radio and supporting public radio. I'm your host, Tom Lounges of Midwest Beat. This program is all about music and the arts, and today I'm featuring two authors, one in studio, one by phone. Coming up a little later in the program, 20 years on the Gold Coast. Lots of things can happen. We're going to find out about some of those celebrity encounters with Louis Dybel. He is an author that is a resident of Northwest Indiana, and we're going to talk about some of the great things he's encountered over the years in the hospitality business. Speaking of hospitality, a relationship began many years ago with a young lady out of Austin, Texas named Kristen Casey. She met rock star Joe Walsh, and the result was 6 years of a relationship and a book that's called Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. We're going to get Kristen on the air in just a few minutes, but right now let's remember Mr. Walsh with one of his most famous songs, all about tearing up hotel rooms and putting holes in walls. Life's been good so far. He lives in hotels, tears up the walls. That was Joe Walsh of the past. Joe is clean and sober these days, and so is Kristen Casey. Kristen is with us. She is the author of a brand new book called Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. Kristen, welcome.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Doing wonderful. And you had a pretty wild life, and it's depicted well in this new book of yours. And you have a career now that is all about recovery and helping other people. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But let's go back to the beginning. You were 20 years old, working as a stripper, when you met Joe Walsh. And according to the book, you weren't even aware of who he was. How did that encounter happen?
Yeah, that's true. I didn't know who he was. I had heard his music. But I didn't know the name of the singer. You know, I was I didn't even bother listening to, you know, like retaining that information when I would hear him on the radio. I just knew Rocky Mountain Way and Life's Been Good because they got a lot of airplay. And, of course, Hotel California, which I had heard in high school. And I probably knew that the Eagles did that song, but I didn't know the names of any of the band members.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was 20, I was stripping in Austin with my friend Vicky, and I had been a dancer for about 2.5 years, and so I had been hearing a lot more classic rock because they played a lot of it at the club. Excuse me. And so Vicky, who was really into classic rock, and she had been to a million concerts, you know, she was just really, and she had met a lot of musicians, and, you know, she was just more into that scene. And she was one of my best girlfriends, and she needed a ride one night to meet this guy she'd been seeing from California, and I didn't really know that much about it. He was some bass player. And so it was like 2:30 in the morning, and I gave her a ride, and as we're heading to the hotel, she says, oh, you should come up and meet his friend, the singer and guitar player. And I still am not clear if she was like trying, if it was kind of a slight
setup,
but I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah. And because I was tired and I thought, oh, you know, yeah, I'll meet him. I'll be polite. He might be interesting. I'll probably stay 15 minutes. You know, I'm sure I'll be bored by then and make polite goodbyes and go home. And so I go upstairs and 15 minutes later, I was in love with him and pretty sure that he was the man I was meant to marry.
Wow. Just, that's a quick revelation.
Yeah. You know, Joe's a really unique individual, and I'm not the first woman. I don't think who's fallen for him really quickly. I mean, he's a real charmer, and it's a very authentic thing. Like it's not an act or anything. And he was just, you know, we had a connection, we had amazing chemistry, and we hit it off right away. And he was just silly and goofy, and that's exactly what I needed in my life. And, yeah, so I ended up staying all night, and we just had a great time. And then the next day, I went to see the show that they were in town to play. You know, he just put me on the will call list. And when he got on stage, and I'm standing in the audience, and he starts to play, that's when I realized, oh, gosh, this guy's famous. I know that song, and I know that song, and oh, my, he's really big, you know. So that was kind of stunning. And on the one hand, it was kind of exciting, like, wow, I'm, you know, I just met a real rock star, and we had a great time last night. But on the other hand, I thought, well, he's a real rock star. He's never going to call me. That was probably a one-night stand. So, and then he did. Later that day, so.
Yeah, on page 27, you mentioned, you know, rock stars don't fall in love with girls like me. But you were proven wrong, obviously. 6 years you spent with this guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, Joe's not a typical rock star, I will say that. I mean, he is in the way that he's amazingly talented and outrageous. And so he really embodies probably a lot of what most people think of as rock star. And without maybe the outrageous ego. I mean, like most addicts, you know, our egos are sort of these weird animals that are huge one day and a vacuum the next.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of insecurities, but of course a lot of rock stars have that side to them too. But I was not someone who hung out at concerts. I mean, I didn't know the names of most of the bands or musicians I really liked. You know, I was just learning that stuff through my DJs at work and through Vicky. I was from the punk scene, and I, you know, they don't really have so much of a, that iconic status. You know, the musicians are just, we're all just sort of peers, and you know, it's a different attitude. So, no, I did not feel like I was a great beauty or I was like any kind of extroverted, overtly sexy type of stereotypical, you know, girl at the rock star would fall in love with, like Paulina Portskova or Tani Katan, or, you know, I just didn't see that. Not that I wouldn't have liked to have been that.
I was going to ask if
really
you had,
feel like I was.
If you had been in any of the videos or anything, because a lot of times the rock star's girlfriends would show up in the videos, and you certainly are an attractive woman. I mean, you should have fit well in that.
Oh, thanks. I think that I grew more confident about just my appearance or maybe had a more healthy attitude about it. But, you know, I was kind of an insecure girl, and I didn't like being on the spotlight. I you know, drinking helped me. I could be in front of a camera or whatever and feel vivacious and beautiful and sexy when I was drinking, which is one of the reasons I had such a drinking problem, because I was pretty insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe's, I know the girlfriend that Joe had before me, Lisa, she was a really beautiful girl, inside and out. And she was in one of his videos, and I remember seeing that and thinking, oh, I could never do that. I wouldn't look as good. I'd be too shy on camera. I was 20 also, so I suppose I could do it now. I'm still getting used to just doing interviews on the radio, actually.
Okay. Well, you seem to be doing a good job at this point.
And, oh, thanks.
One thing that I did want to ask you, because of just a personal connection, I've always been a huge, huge fan, and he was an influence to me in radio, was Wolfman Jack, and you had some very close encounters with Wolf. What was he like as a person? We see the big, over-the-top persona in public, but what was he like behind the scenes?
You know, I'm glad you asked that. He was maybe my favorite friend of Joe's. I mean, there were a few friends of Joe's, celebrities, who were just incredible in person, you know, as good or way better than you could hope or expect them to be. But Wolf was definitely one of them. And he was different. Like, I only met him the one time, but he did hang out all evening. And he was so sweet and so, you know, really attuned. Like, he was not all about the Wolfman Jack. He was just about who he was talking to. He wanted to know all about you. He was just really kind of smart. You know, I like the way his mind worked. Like, he wanted to talk, I don't know how we ended up talking about feminism and female empowerment and the power of female sexuality and relationships and the challenges of being in relationships. He was very humble, and he talked about what it was like to be a rock star. And we had a whole conversation about how difficult it is to be in a relationship with a rock star, and what their egos are like and their insecurities are like, and how mm-hmm. important it is for you have to have a strong woman to understand a guy like that. And, you know, he was really humble. He was really sweet. He was funny. He was philosophical and very generous. If you read that whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a little outrageous, but you know, he just came by one day, and that's kind of what it was like living with Joe. Like, you just never knew who was going to show up at the front door most of the time. It might be Nina Blackwood just, you know, showed up one day, and Harry Nilsson just showed up one day to hang out, and Stevie Nicks came over one night, and, you know, we couldn't get her to leave, and...
I wish I had that problem with Stevie.
I know, right? I know. I mean, if you have to be stuck with a guest, Stevie Nicks is definitely the person you want to hang out. She is
definitely
entertaining as anything. I mean, I know she's clean and sober now, and she's got a really delightful personality, I think, whether she's sober or not. Like, the night she was with us, she was, I don't know if she was on something. It seemed to me like she was. And Joe said that she probably was. You know, back then we all were.
Right.
But she was highly entertaining. Like, she was not the guest who wouldn't leave in an annoying way, just because it was 4:30 in the morning.
Right.
That was the whole problem.
Another encounter you had that I'm interested in, a lot of my listeners may not realize who he is, and that is Terry Reid. We're going to play a song that you had mentioned that you like, Super Lungs, in just a second. But Terry Reid, at one point, was... picked or thought of to be the lead singer of Led Zeppelin back in the day. And I don't know whatever happened with that scenario, why it never turned out and that Robert wound up being the singer. But what was Terry like? Well, you know what? Let's play the song first so the listeners can hear him. And then tell me a little bit about your connection with Terry Reid.
She's only 14, but she knows.
Super Lungs, Terry Reid. Terry Reid, for those of you that don't know, is an amazing British musician. And for a while after the Yardbirds broke up, Jimmy Page had talked about having him be the lead singer of the new Yardbirds, which, of course, evolved into Led Zeppelin. And my guest, Kristen Casey, a book author of Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh, has a great picture with Terry. And I've got to think there's a good story to go with it, because you had mentioned that you were a big fan of his music.
Yeah, I mean, his voice, it kills me to this day every time I hear him sing. It's just brilliant. It's just gorgeous. I mean, I wish he had been a huge star. I wish he was a household name, because he deserves to be.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, incredibly talented, just amazing music. And that psychedelic soul that just never gets old to me. I met Terry, I think it was John Entwistle, actually, who introduced us. We were, it was before I moved in with Joe, so it was like 1990, maybe. And or 91, it was right before I moved in, and I was in LA, and we went to dinner with John Entwistle and Joe and a couple other people, and John brought Terry happened to be there, and he introduced us, and then I think Joe and he were already friends, but then we bought a house, and Terry just kind of started coming over every now and then, hanging out and shooting pool. You know, we had friends over a lot, just to hang out in our party room and shoot pool. And you know, Terry was the sweetest guy. I every time I think about him back then, I think about, he just seemed like a puppy dog. Like he was a very affectionate person, and he was just always, you know, telling funny stories, and he could be kind of the life of the party, but he just had like a tender soul. And I got the sense that, you know, he wasn't exactly where he wanted to be in his life, you know, like mm-hmm. He didn't seem bitter about it, but I think we all recognized that, you know, he was just this incredible talent that wasn't doing these huge shows that we probably all thought he should be doing. And so we would just hang out, and I would sometimes brush his hair, and we'd shoot pool, and he'd tell us funny stories. And, yeah, we got to be friends. And let's see, what else? I forgot to throw the question that you had asked.
Oh, just basically what your relationship was with him, that you became friends, how that happened. Because I didn't realize that Terry and Joe were buddies. You know, Terry is very famous in England, but not very famous here. And I didn't know he actually came here
He was living in L.A. at the time. I think he was married. I think they got divorced around that time, maybe. And so Rick, the bass player, who was Joe's bass player and best friend, you know, we saw Rick almost every day. He lived nearby, and we were in Studio City, and he was in North Hollywood. And so Rick had a recording studio in his garage. So if we didn't have people over in our playroom shooting pool, then they were over in Rick's garage fooling around in his studio. And so Terry was just one of that sort of usual crowd that was oftentimes found at our house or at Rick's house. And, you know, when I first met him, not the first night, but shortly after I met him, he told me the story about how he ended up not being in Led Zeppelin, if you haven't heard it. I think I mentioned it in the book, but you know, he was like 16 when they asked him to do that. And that's how good he was. He was already making a name for himself at like 16. Maybe it was 17, but you know, to join Led Zeppelin, he would have to go on tour. Legally he couldn't. He wasn't old enough to do that. He had to get like parental his parents sign off on it, and he just looked at me and he said, "My mom wouldn't sign the permission slip." So Terry didn't get to be in the in Led Zeppelin because his mom wouldn't let him, basically.
Wow, what a shame. Yeah, I know. Yeah. He used to open up for the Hollies and the Stones and everybody with his group, the Jaywalkers, back in the mid-60s, and he was making a name for himself then, just like young Steve Winwood did with Spencer Davis. I mean, those were two guys that just jumped out and says, "We are ready for the stardom." And, you know, Stevie got his, but Terry never really got his due, and it's a shame. It was nice to see him in your book, because he needs to be recognized.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, we had a special relationship, he and I, and I talk about it a little bit in the book, and it's, you know, it's a complicated, convoluted kind of thing.
Your life is a little complicated.
Yeah, let's just say that. It really is, especially when you're an addict, and especially when you're an addict who's living with an addict who's a rock star, and there's a 20-year age difference, and, mm-hmm. yeah, that's not usually what you would call a simple Recipe for Simplicity.
Now, you had mentioned Harry Nielsen. You had mentioned John Entwistle, two renowned party animals. And, of course, you're living with Joe Walsh. And now you are looking back with clear eyes. You and Joe are both sober and promoting a healthy lifestyle. If you talk to Joe or you see his interviews, he's very, very pro-healthy lifestyle. Did the two of you in any way help each other get to this plateau in your lives?
Oh, what a good question. The answer to that would be yes and no.
Okay.
We did in a very roundabout sort of way, not probably in the way... we did it in the most painful way possible. I'll put it that way. Because here's the thing. You know, I talk about this in my book that I believed, and I still do, that Joe's my soulmate. But I believe that I have more than one soulmate. And I also believe now that soulmates are maybe a little bit different. It's a different definition than I had when I was younger. And I think what happens is, you know, your soulmate is the person who's going to initially bring out the best in you and then probably also bring out the worst in you. And it gives you a choice to make in your life, whether you're going to take a look at the issues that are coming up and address them and be a better version of yourself and hopefully as your partner does the same thing, or you're going to let those issues take over and until you spiral downward and crash and burn, which is what happened to us. And so sometimes that saying about hitting your bottom, you have to hit your bottom, you know, before you're willing to get help and get sober.
Right.
Well, for me, that was true. I had a very low bottom. And, you know, for Joe, I would say that, you know, he had a long run. And in the 6 years we were together over a 7-year period, the first 5 of them was before he got sober. He got sober right around year 6, right when we got back together. So those years were the years that he was going downhill with his addictions and even, I think, creatively and career-wise, you could say the same thing. You know, those two issues are obviously entwined. You know, mm-hmm. If your addictions are getting the better of you, you're not going to put out your best work, most likely.
Right.
So, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of, you know, I hate to say this, but I helped spur those addictions because I sort of had a handle on my addictions to a degree when he and I met. I had put down the hard drugs and I was drinking too much, but I was back in school and he was using coke. And I think that he kind of assumed that, oh, this is a girl who can handle, you know, she put aside the drugs. So this is a good woman for me to be with, you know, mm-hmm. We can drink together, but she won't, she'll be safer on the cocaine. Well, that turned out not to be true. So what happened was, within a couple of years, you know, our addictions were just running away with us. And so he hit his bottom and the Eagles kind of came in and swooped him up and got him into rehab and then, you know, took off with their reunion tour. And so, you could say it was the catalyst for some of that, or our relationship was, I mean, an addict's going to hit his bottom at some point, but,
right.
But when you're living with another addict, it's going to happen faster. So, unfortunately, I had another couple of years to go with my addictions. So we did bring out the best in each other at first, and then we brought out the worst in each other. Had I not met him and gone through that experience, it might have taken me a lot longer to hit my bottom. I might have been 40 when I got sober instead of 29 or 30. I can't speak for him, but it takes what it takes. And we had some really, really good times before things really turned sour, and you know, so I don't regret that, and I am glad that I spiraled as quickly as I did, and I was able to get sober when I did, and I'm thrilled that he was able to get sober and go back to the music that was, you know, that really is one of the, you know, his purposes on this planet, as far
right.
as I can see, you know.
I saw him, was it last summer or summer before, he was out with Bad Company, and Paul Rogers is an old friend, and we were hanging out, and I had seen Joe in the early years, and I had seen Joe now, and I had never seen him perform clean, and he was absolutely amazing. You know, Joe was always the life of the party kind of guy, and I thought, okay, you know, when you change that element, is he still going to be humorous, funny? Is he still going to be the life of the party? And it it proved that he didn't need any substances or alcohol or anything to be the rock star he really is.
Yeah, I think that's true. And there was a time when he first got sober that, you know, life is, it's a very scary, maybe it sounds silly, but when you're so used to having that crutch of drugs and alcohol, and then suddenly you're sober. And for me, I didn't have to go on a stage, and I didn't have a whole fan base or a worldwide audience watching me. And it was still difficult for me to face every day and try to figure out how to even talk to people or function in a normal way, because I had been drinking and using for so long. Well, for Joe, of course, you know, he had the same issues on a much bigger stage. And so in the beginning, you know, he was quite nervous. In fact, I remember when he did the first Eagles show of that tour, it was like a soft opening. It wasn't a huge concert thing. It was sort of an invitation only thing. But he was so nervous he couldn't speak. It was the first time he was going to do a show sober, and he'd only been sober for a couple of months, I think, at that point, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months. But he was surrounded by, his brothers and the Eagles. And as the tour went on, you could see his confidence just rising really quickly and just kind of getting back in the swing of things. So, you know, his humor changed a little bit. You know, he was always just the funniest guy. He could, I mean, just silly, goofy, funny. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of took a while to come back out. And now it's, it came out in a more sort of balanced way. Like, there were times when we were living together, I was like, all right, take it down a notch, honey. It's just, you're like a one-man circus here, and right. Every now and then you want him to just be serious.
Right.
But, once he got sober, his sense of humor is still there. Like, you see him in interviews, he can just be really funny and silly and goofy, but it's like not all the time. He's not on all the time.
Right. Yeah, it used to be like he was constantly in character.
Yes, exactly.
I remember he hung out here in Chicago a lot and worked with the old Loop station back in the day. And he was working with Steve Dahl and all these different guys over the years and good friends with them. And he was always on. Every time you saw him in Chicago, he was always on, whether it was on the street, in the studio, wherever. And but he still hasn't lost it. Like I said, I was very impressed with his performance.
He's singing and playing better than ever. It's it's just amazing, because honestly, if he'd have just been as good as he was before, I think everyone would have been perfectly fine with that. But he just kept getting better and better. It was like, it was mind-blowing to see him. After we broke up and I finally got sober, and then, the Eagles just kept on touring, and I'd see them play, and I'd see him play, and it was just phenomenal.
Now, I understand that you and Joe have stayed in contact. You don't, hang out anymore, but you are in contact. Has he given you any feedback on the book?
You know, we did stay in contact. It wasn't regular by any means. Sometimes a couple of years would go by, we wouldn't talk or see each other, and then he would come through Texas with the Eagles, or maybe usually with the Eagles, sometimes for just on tour or for corporate shows. And so I saw him a few times after we broke up over the next, 15 years or so, 10 or 12 years. And we would talk on the phone, but the last time we were in touch was 2011. And so, he had gotten married, I think, right around and then, so that's not surprising. That just happened.
Right.
We just lost touch. So I don't actually know if he's read it. I hope he likes it. I don't know. I don't expect to hear from him. I haven't. I tried to reach him when I first started writing it, and I didn't get any answers back, so I don't even know if he got those emails, or, he might have changed his phone number, whatever.
Have you gotten any feedback from some of the other artists that you mentioned in here?
No, I haven't. I would love to talk to some of them. I'd always like to say hi to Terry. He was in Austin for South by some years ago, maybe 10 years ago or something, so we chatted then. But I've lost touch with almost everyone except for Dave and Cece Edmonds. I just love Dave Edmonds, and they were good friends of ours who also lived in LA at the time, and then they moved back to Europe. But I lost touch with them as well. I have gotten I have heard from friends, you know, some friends that I knew back then that I've just heard about the book and read it and called or emailed to tell me how much they liked it. So that's been really fun and gratifying. But, you know, when Joe and I broke up, when I moved out to L.A., his friends became my friends. And then when we broke up, you know, he got to keep them all. So I didn't.
That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Dave and Cece made a point of staying in touch. But most of the others, you know, I was in my alcoholic spiral. I was not someone anyone really wanted to stay in touch with at the time.
Right. Oh, there's Dave Edmonds right now. I hear you knocking, Dave.
Oh, good.
Let's play this for a few minutes, and we'll be back with my special guest, Kristen Casey. Now you're knocking on my door. I hear you knocking, but you can't come in. I hear you knocking. Go back where you've been. I begged you not to go, but you said goodbye. I hear you knocking. Come on in. This is Midwest Beat. I'm Tom Lounge as your host. My guest on this hour is Kristen Casey. We're talking about Dave Edmonds, one of the many rock stars that she has come to know and call friend in her relationship with Joe Walsh, which is the topic of her new book, Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh, which is now available. How long has it been out, Kristy?
Oh, I think it's been, in fact, today's the 13th, so it's been a month.
Wow. Happy anniversary.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
How's it been doing for you? Are you getting good response? Is it doing what you thought it would?
You know, I personally had no expectations. I didn't want to have any expectations because I didn't want to be disappointed and I didn't want to get my hopes up. But to be honest, it's actually doing better than expected, I hear. I'm trying to just stay focused on you know, doing the interviews and promoting the book, and I'm hopefully going to be doing more about the themes of recovery, addiction and recovery, mental illness as well, coming up soon, like a lot of sort of recovery-oriented podcasts and such, because that's a really important topic to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, but apparently from what I'm told, like the reviews have been good, and we're getting great feedback, and apparently it's been selling better than average, or that's what I'm told. I was told by some writer friends of mine that the smartest thing to do is
don't read your reviews.
Exactly. Don't pay attention to Amazon rankings.
Well, I'll tell you, I did look over some of the reviews, and you're right. They are very positive, which is wonderful, because a lot of times we hear, you know, a wife or a girlfriend or somebody writes a book and everyone thinks it's the National Enquirer style tell-all. And while there are some revealing stories, shall we say, it seems like it was written from the heart and honesty. It seems like this was something you had to do in order to continue moving forward.
Yeah, actually, thanks for saying that. That is very well said, and that is how I feel about it. You know, I got sober in the program. I went to meetings, 12-step meetings, and though I don't go all that often anymore, the principles behind the steps are very near and dear to me, and I base my life on them every day. And so I believe in being of service. And I also believe that, you know, addiction is one of the biggest problems we have in this country, in this population, and just as human beings. It's a devastating situation. It's a devastating illness. And I want to help destigmatize it. And I feel that sharing stories, like through addiction memoirs and through interviews and through anyone in recovery chooses to do that, you know, whether it's through a fictionalized short story or a poem or a memoir or just in person, in meetings, that talking about it and being open about it will help destigmatize it and also, you know, help the medical community and the families and the loved ones understand the disease better. And if we can understand it better, where it comes from, and what it's like, and what is, how that addict is perceiving life and perceiving their options, whether they see them or not, we can have better treatments and better prevention. And to me, that's very, very important. And when I got sober, it was a life and death situation. And I did not really want to be alive. I decided killing myself was probably not what I was meant to do. And so I made that conscious decision not to do it. And I did it sort of at the last minute. And I knew that day, and this is held true, if I don't have a purpose in life, if I don't find my purpose, if I don't feel like I'm adding something, that I'm leaving this place someday a better earth than it was when I got here, even in some small way, then I don't have a reason to get out of bed in the morning, and I might start drinking again.
Right.
And so one of my purposes is to hopefully just add to the collective knowledge of addiction and maybe make it easier for a small handful of people.
Now
who are going through the same thing.
You have your own company, KCConsulting.com, and that's K with a KC behind it. KCConsulting.com. Tell me a little bit about that. Now, that is working a little bit with the addiction issues, but also with intimacy stuff. How did you fall into that?
I did kind of fall into it. The thing about addiction and recovery and intimacy issues and sexuality and sexual dysfunction, they seem like two separate topics, but in truth, they can be very tied in, because for an addict, true intimacy can be it can be very elusive, and it can be why the addict turns to drugs and alcohol, because it's a very I grew up feeling very isolated. I did not feel attuned to my parents. I felt I had very low self-esteem. I had a lot of shame, and all of those things are very isolating, you know. And parenting is the most difficult job in the world, and when you have five kids like my parents did, it's really hard to give them all the attention that they need. And I was a very sensitive kid, so I grew up feeling very isolated. And so intimacy has always been an issue for me. And it was one of the main factors that led me into my addictions, was that I felt very isolated, and when I drank and used, I felt like I was able to connect with people. So while I don't necessarily work in the field of addiction and recovery, I did have intimacy issues while I was using, and also when I got sober, it took a long time for me to really learn how to connect with people, to learn how to be open and authentic and vulnerable. And those are the same issues that a person who feels disconnected or is maybe having sexual dysfunction or just intimacy issues in their personal life, in their relationships, in their dating life, in their marriage, those are the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
Being afraid to be vulnerable and authentic and being inhibited about self-expression. And so those two issues are very tied in, I think, recovery and intimacy. And so I found my own way. I found a lot of help through therapy and through a lot of different tactics and methods. And I discovered a few years ago that there was a newish field called intimacy coaching. I was thinking about going back to school to get my degree and becoming a sex therapist. And in that research, while I was looking at schools, I discovered this field of intimacy coaching. And I just realized this is custom made for me. It's exactly where I need to be. And so I've been doing it for the last couple of years. And
how does that differ from being a sex therapist? The two seem to be very comparable.
Yeah, well, they're very much they're in the same field and they're related, but there is a big difference. First of all, most sex therapists have a master's degree, and they have quite a bit of training in a very specific form of talk therapy and a lot of different methods, like different types of behavioral therapy and all that. As a coach, I got my training. I had some intensive training, but it wasn't 6 years of college. So there's no licensing program necessarily for coaches. I am working towards certification through the International Professional Surrogates Organization. And that applies towards my coaching. But coaching is something that you can do without a college degree, and it's more experiential. And so for a lot of clients, a lot of my clients have been in therapy for a while, and it's gotten them to a certain point, and now they just need to work one-on-one in a more experiential way so that they can move forward in life with their relationship.
Are you still based in Austin with your therapy programs?
I do. I mean, I am, yes. I came back to Austin, I think, in 98, and it really is my home. I miss California, but Austin is where I put down roots. And, you know, it's this special little part of Texas that's a little more progressive, a little funkier. It's got a great music scene. And,
definitely has a good
music
scene. And there's
a handful of intimacy coaches here. Yeah?
It definitely has a great music scene.
Yeah. You know, and I really need that. I mean, that's just something that keeps me, even as a writer, just being surrounded by creative people who are making the sacrifices of time and money and energy and just to pursue their art, you know, like it's a very supportive environment for someone who's a writer. And also it's just a very inspiring place to be. You know, the West Coast is so progressive and open-minded about these things. There's a lot of intimacy coaches on the West Coast, but there's not very many in the South or in Texas. There's a handful of us in Austin, and we all work a little bit differently. So I stay very busy. I work 7 days a week.
Okay. You were talking about the music scene and how great it is in Austin. And, of course, you lived for 6 years with Joe Walsh on the road, and part of that was during the Ringo Starr All-Star Tour. And you mentioned, and there's a great picture with Billy Preston, and he was just such a spiritual guy. You seem to have bonded with him of all the different guys on that tour. Tell us a little bit about Billy after we play a little sample of one of his most famous songs. This is Will It Go Round in Circles?
When it fly high like a bird up in the sky, when it go round in circles, when it fly high like a bird up in the sky, fly high. I've got a story, ain't got no morrow. Let the bad guy win every once in a while. In a while, when it go round in circles, when it fly high like a bird up in the sky, when it go round in circles, when it fly high like a bird up in the sky.
Will it go round in circles? It seems that life does move in circles, in a circular motion. Joining me, Kristen Casey. KC to her friends. She is an intimacy coach. She is a former girlfriend of Joe Walsh. She's a book author of Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. And while with Joe, you were on the tour, the Ringo All-Star Tour, and got to know Billy Preston, who we just heard there, and other famous folks that Ringo rubbed elbows with on stage. Who were some of your favorites, and why did Billy stick out?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the funnest tour. That was definitely a highlight of my whole relationship with Joe. I loved everyone in that band. Levon Helm, especially, he and I just really connected. I adored him. And Rick Danko, was one of the sweetest people ever. Dr. John, who is just, you know, he is a very unique individual and super sweet. And Billy Preston, especially for me on that tour, he was the highlight of the show. Billy was not someone that I felt like I was able to get really close to backstage necessarily. You know, like all the guys were always very friendly, but Billy and I just didn't form like a strong friendship. But every night when he would go out and do Will It Go Round in Circles, if I was backstage, if I was in the bathroom, if I was in the catering room, if I was wherever yammering with a friend, I would run outside to the audience and just, you know, the whole audience would be on their feet, you know, dancing our butts off, because it was just, you know, he was an amazing musician, you know.
Yeah.
You would just see him behind his keyboards, and I mean, he was a force, and he was, and that smile, you know, when he would,
with that big gaping gap in his front teeth, he'd smile at you. Yeah.
He was beautiful. I just adored him. I adored his music, you know, and he'd get out there and dance, and, you know, he was dreamy. He was kind of dreamy.
Mm-hmm. I saw him in 74 when George Harrison toured, the only time George toured America without the Beatles. And I was at the Chicago Stadium and saw. And Billy had the afro from hell, basically. It was he looked like a giant mushroom on stage. And he'd play the piano and the hair would move. It was he looked like a living bobblehead. And like you said, he just related and connected to the audience. I think he was the highlight. And we had some big names on that show. I mean, Ravi Shankar was there, Tom Scott and the LA Express, all these guys, of course, George Harrison. But Billy, he just commanded it. And when I saw, you know, that you were on that tour, I just had to ask, because I never had a chance to interview him or meet him. But he was that magnetic offstage as well then?
Yeah, I thought so. You know, we would ride on the bus together, and if he was in a good mood, you know, you never knew, because some of the guys, you know, would be tired at different points or whatever. And I tried not to, after a show especially, bother him or anything. But if he was in a good mood, he could be the life of the party. And, you know, I would just love to watch him laughing about whatever and smiling. And he just had an amazing energy. Sometimes on that tour, as amazing as the shows were, being backstage or being on the bus were some of the funnest times and some of my best memories, because those guys were just really good guys. And, you know, I remember one time, in fact, they were on the bus ride back to the hotel after the show. They all started sharing stories about Little Richard, and they each had some weird interaction with Little Richard. And so they were one-upping each other with these anecdotes, and they were all true. I mean, they were just, you know, I think they really enjoyed being with each other too, and playing in that band where they got to be with their peers, and you know, there was not too much pressure on any one guy. And Ringo was a real unifying force. You know, he just had so much love for all of them. The energy and the vibe on that tour was just so full of love and positivity, and yeah, it was a beautiful thing.
I got to ask you about the title of the book, Rock Monster. It almost suggests it's a different type of book. Joe doesn't come off in this book as being a rock monster. A party animal, maybe, but the term monster might throw some people. Is there a reason you called it Rock Monster?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, actually. Okay, so Rock Monster was my working title for the book. I never intended to publish it under that title, but I just wanted something, you know, I needed a name for it while I was writing it,
because
the whole process is 3 or 4 years. And so, you know, it was a play on words, because Joe is a rock star, and because I was addicted to crack for the second half of our relationship, and so I was smoking a lot of crack rocks. The term monster itself actually was Joe's and my pet name for each other, and it, you know, it wasn't an insult, and it didn't necessarily mean like a big, bad, dangerous beast, you know, like he wasn't a violent person or anything like that, but a monster was someone who just went overboard. So, like, if we stayed up for a couple days in a row, we might look at each other and say, man, we really monstered, or boy, you sure did a monster this weekend, or, you know, it was it was like a little joke, our little pet name. So when I called it Rock Monster, I was thinking, well, he's a rock star, and he was like a monster, like, a party monster. Mm-hmm. And I was a crack monster. You know, I went overboard with the crack. So it was kind of a personal to me, and I never meant, my publisher loved the title, so they wanted to keep it. And I said, you don't think it's going to sound like I'm calling him a monster? And they said, no, that's not how we took it. So I hope nobody's taking it that way.
Well, I could see people, if they don't really read the book, that they could look at and say, oh, he must be horrible, you know, to have this pretty girl write this story and call him a rock monster. But as you read it, like I said, I mean, it shows him to be quite the party animal, but also very loving and caring and a very unique human being in many ways, even during the bad days. And that said, you detail things so well in this book. You really do write well. And
oh, thank you.
I've got to wonder, because, I mean, I used to book clubs back in the 80s, and I did tours, and, I mean, I remember how decadent that decade truly was, and you were in the thick of it in a way I never was. How did you keep the facts straight? How do you remember everything? I mean, I can't remember things from that era, and you're detailed in them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I do have an exceptional memory that I've discovered as the years have gone by. However, I would not say that I remember everything by any means. In fact, I have big holes in my memory. So if I didn't remember a scene or an interaction really well, then I would not include it, or I would only refer to it in as much as I remembered the certain essence of it that might apply to the story I'm telling. But to me, it was vital that I only share what I remembered very clearly. And so there's a point, especially towards the end, where I start to get really into the crack, where I even say, my memories of this whole period are very foggy. I remember this, I remember that, I remember this. And so I kind of sum up a good 6 month or 10 month period in a couple of pages tops.
Did you keep a journal or a diary during that time at all?
I kept a journal for the first half of our relationship fairly regularly, and then pretty sporadically after that. I have about 1,000 pictures. We took a ton of pictures. So I actually was able to go through my photos, and, you know, they did sort of help jar my memory, but they also, you know, were sort of photographic proof of certain events as they played out. So between those two things, plus, you know, I had a couple of girlfriends who I was close with at the time, and so they were witnesses to a lot of the things that went down and things that I shared with them at that time. But the other thing is, you know, when you're going through something really powerful, these memories, these events that you go through, whether they're traumatic or tremendously exciting, like, you know, when your boyfriend proposes or whatever, or you're meeting Ringo Starr, they can get sort of implanted in your memory in such a way that they're very fresh. You know, some of my memories are a little traumatic, like the fighting and stuff, and some of the conversations when we were really being harsh with each other, and when some of those painful memories, I didn't process those very well. Those got stuck until I wrote the book, and I actually managed to process them in a way I hadn't for 25 years. But you'll find that when people go through really powerful experiences, sometimes those memories will stay very, very fresh. And then once they process them, they'll actually sort of lose some of that that vibrancy, which is a good thing, because really it's important to move on. So, but the journal helped a lot, definitely.
Okay. What's next for you? The book is out. Your career is going well as a therapist. What does the future hold for KC?
Well, you know, I'm really excited that I got this book published, because publishing in this day and age is getting, you know, it's going through a lot of a transition, and there's a lot of self-publishing, and things are sort of changing all the time. And so I've always wanted to be a writer. That's something I've wanted for, you know, 40 years, since I was about 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I have another couple of books in me, so I definitely hope to write about more about my work. My next book is going to be a lot about chemistry and attraction and intimacy issues, and it's going to tell the story. It's going to be another memoir. I think a little bit less dark. This one's going to be a little bit more fun and maybe even a little racier, because I am going to be talking about relationships and intimacy. But I'm just pursuing my career as an intimacy coach. It's keeping me very busy, and I got a couple more books to write, and then we'll see.
Well, Rock Monster's a little racy itself, I gotta say. It's not PG.
Yeah, it kind of runs the gamut. It's definitely a sex, drugs, and rock and roll book, and it's got some darkness in it. You know, there's that second to the last chapter, I talk about what led me to my suicide attempt. So I guess I'll just say it's a little, the next book is going to be less dark. Just as racy, but less dark. Yeah.
All right. And again, you can keep up with Casey at kcaseyconsulting.com. Is there another website or anything that we can reach you at?
Yeah, actually, I do have a new author website, and it's kristencaseyauthor.com, and that's Kristen with an I-N, not E-N.
And with a K.
Casey Author, yeah. And so those two sites link back to each other. So if you find one, you'll find the other.
Okay, very good. Well, I have another guest that's joining us, another author, Louis Dybel. He's here in the studio. He just came in, and he's got a book called 20 Years on the Gold Coast, and he's in the hospitality business, in which you may have even met at some point, because he would be basically there, and he's got stories of Bruce Springsteen and all these different celebrities. Say hello, Louis.
How are you, Tom? Great to be here.
And Kristen, just curious because you guys overlap in one area, and I'll let you go, and that is Ringo Starr. You had toured with Ringo, and Lewis, Ringo checked in not once but twice at your hotel?
Yeah, I had a couple of different interactions with him that were memorable, and I was thinking as she was talking, there had to be a point where I saw her in the hotel with, you know, it gets to be so customary after that many years where you're literally turning around and seeing celebrities to the point where it almost, if you allowed yourself to just be sort of jaded about it, but, you know, there are so many stories that weren't in my book that, you know, that didn't seem worthy of the book, but, you know, hundreds of other little tiny interactions as well.
Now, one of the things I've got to ask you, since I actually have two people in conversation here that have both met Ringo, I was supposed to do an interview with him when him and Barbara Bach were in town promoting Caveman, but something came up, I couldn't do it. So I never had a chance to. I met Paul, got to see George, but never had an encounter with Ringo. Now, he's always been one of my favorite Beatles, so I'm going to ask you both. Ringo has a reputation of being very caustic and very difficult and maybe unfriendly, perhaps. Now, you both have met him in different incarnations in different ways. Ladies first, Kristen, what was Ringo like?
Well, I met him in 89, and I got to say, he stands out in my mind as one of the most loving, attuned, caring, delightful individuals I've ever met. I have heard those stories about him, and I don't think he would deny them. And in fact, Barbara, you know, I had talked to Barbara about some of her past with him, and so... Yeah, I'm sure they're true. I was lucky enough to meet him when he was 2 years sober, and he was just wonderful. I try to impart that in the book because I adored him.
Now, you mentioned the fact that Ringo was sober at the point you worked with him. You and Joe were not at that time, if I'm correct.
Right.
Was it difficult for Ringo to work with those that still had addictions? And was he preachy at all? Like, you really got to clean up your act? Or did he give you the time to find your own rock bottom?
Oh, yeah, no, he wasn't preachy at all. You know, he had a rule that there was no drugs or drinking backstage. I think some of the backstage areas might have had, every now and then I remember there was some drinking, and it might have been a show where it wasn't completely up to him or something, but everybody respected him so much, and everyone was so glad to be on board and doing this that, you know, they just did their best to keep their addictions, whichever guys in the band were drinking or using, and Joe was one of them, to really manage them as quietly and discreetly as possible.
Okay.
When on tour with Ringo. And I did the same thing on the first tour. I barely drank and didn't do too many drugs, relatively. And then on the second tour, I had already started smoking crack, and so I was completely off the deep end, and I brought it on tour, and I ended up getting thrown off the tour, and Ringo even offered to put me in rehab that night. You know, he said, I'll send you home or I'll send you to rehab. It's your choice. And so he was never preachy. He was never judgy. He was very well aware of what was going on. But I didn't, until I brought the drugs on tour, you know, he didn't ever get in my face about it. And then when he did, he was very, very polite about it. Very kind. I mean, he offered to send me to rehab. So
yeah, you can't knock a guy for that.
You're right.
Lewis, what was your encounter? Now, you were in the hospitality, and he was a client. Obviously, you don't interact or intrude much with that. I remember working in hospitality, and when the rock stars came through, you really weren't supposed to ask them for photos or signatures or anything like that. And I'm sure you've lasted over 20 years in the business, so you must be following the rules. But you did encounter him. It's in your book. What was your impact of his personality?
It was early in my career, so I was completely starstruck, and my mom was one of those Beatles fanatics with the beehive hair that would pass out and stuff. So these were larger than life people to me during my childhood. And I'm glad that I got to interact with him twice, because I saw him on different times in different hotels. And it's one of the points that I make in the book is that these celebrities that everyone almost seems to think aren't human. I mean, few people are living legends at that level that he was at.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see him once in a very calm, area of the hotel. I went upstairs and chatted with him and took him out and had to do the things that a manager would have to do for a VIP. And he seemed like it couldn't be him because he was just so normal and relaxed. And I thought, wow, how do you keep your balance, you know, mm-hmm. being world famous, all that. And I was impressed by it. And then I remember seeing him, you know, a couple of years later after a show, And I was at, working at a 5-star hotel a block away from that hotel. And, you know, his limo pulled up after the show, and he got out with his wife, Barbara. And out of nowhere, I mean, it was always shocking to me where these paparazzi came from. I mean, you could see all around you for 100 feet. It was almost like a cartoon where they were popping out of the, you know, the flower pots and just dropping out of the sky. You know, it was, where do these people come from in 3 seconds flat? And he was pissed. I mean, he really was. There was a crowd that came immediately around him, people taking pictures. He just had finished a four-hour show. They jostled into his wife a little bit, and he lost it. And naturally, hey, right. You know, it's his wife. And he, you know, he made sure that... you know, there was no one else within 10 feet of her after that. He screamed some expletives, and, you know, we got him right in, and, you know. Okay.
And was all good. But it was, yeah, you can understand that.
Absolutely. But if that was my only interaction with him, I might have thought to myself, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so great. Okay.
Did you have any problems like that, Kristen, when you and Joe were arriving or leaving or going to dinner or anything in a limo, that the paparazzi or the public in general would get a little too intrusive?
In the years that I was with Joe, that it didn't really come up all that much. I remember being in New Zealand. I think it was in Christchurch. And so we're talking about a, you know, relatively small city. I mean, maybe not small for New Zealand, but word got out that Joe was in town, and we were antiquing, and we got surrounded by like six or eight fans one day. They kind of followed us or whatever. And that kind of freaked me out. We'd only been together for 6 months or so at the time. And, I just saw Joe as my boyfriend and the man I loved. And whenever his fans would show up, even just a handful of them, I would always get freaked out by his fame. I think there was a part of me that just knew it was a big, powerful animal. It wasn't exciting to me, but Joe always had fans even when he was on that downslide. When the Eagles got back together and he was sober, so the last year of our relationship together, you know, things were really different. He started to become more recognizable in public, but he also took great pains. You know, the Eagles were really smart about security and stuff. So, mm-hmm. Those are my recollections. It was... I think Joe, before the Eagles got back together, I think he kind of enjoyed sometimes having fans come up, especially when they would say, you know, they were fans since the James Gang days.
Right.
Because they were always the most, like, authentic, hardcore fans. You know, they really were about the music. And, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us and staying a little longer than I had planned, or you had planned, rather. Kristen Casey, author of Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. Keep up with her at KristenCaseyAuthor.com. Or kcaseyconsulting.com. Either website will take you to the other, and you can keep up with her and follow her with the forthcoming books that we will wait to have you write and have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. That was a lot of fun. That was great.
All right.
Appreciate it.
No problem. We're going to leave with a song, Kristen with a song that kind of ties both of my authors together, and let's play that now. This is Mr. Ringo Starr, and of course, he is the greatest.
When I was a little boy, way back home in Liverpool, my mama told me I was great. Then when I was a teenager, I knew that I had got something going. I was great. And now I'm a man. A woman took me by the hand. And you know what she told me? I was great. Mirror. great. Yes, my name is Billy Shears. You know it has been for so many years.
As the audience goes wild for the greatest. One of the greatest drummers, one of the greatest celebrities of all time, one of the Fabs, Mr. Ringo Starr. And he is the connection between my two guests. We just said goodbye to Kristen Casey. She is the author of Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. Joe, of course, a member of the All-Star Band for a number of tours. And with us now, Louis Dybel. He is a resident of Griffith, correct?
Yes, sir.
Were you born and raised in Indiana?
I was born and raised in Hammond, a third world country called Hammond, Indiana, as I like to say.
Now, how did you get into the hospitality business? You have written a book, 20 Years on the Gold Coast in Chicago, and it's, I don't want to say a tell-all, it's a revelation of some of your encounters with very famous people, politicians, rock stars, movie stars, celebrity sports stars, pretty much a who's who of anyone that's famous you have come in contact with. Now, 20 years. I'm assuming it took you a little while to write the book. So it's probably, what, 22 years now?
You know, that's funny that you say that. I could have named it 30 Years on the Gold Coast, but I didn't want everyone to know how old I was.
You just did.
I just did. But I said to myself, 20 years still sounds relevant. I thought if it was 30 that I might lose some of the kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but most of those stories did happen within the first 20 years.
Okay. Now, how did you get into hospitality? How does a kid from Griffith wind up on the Gold Coast doing what you did?
That's a very funny story to me personally. My best friend had bombed out of college, you know,
okay.
Just continued to just, and his mom had just had enough. You know, we're about 19 or 20. And she says, "You're going to hotel school. That's it. You know, no more."
I didn't know there was such a thing. There really is a hotel school?
You know, there's a couple of colleges that emphasize in it specifically and do like, you know, Cornell being the most famous, Michigan State, Purdue, Cal. Believe it or not, Purdue has one of the
big hospitality degrees.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can do that. And there were schools that were streamlining it, you know, to get past the electives and stuff and just sort of understand the business and get in. This is the late 80s, you know. So he had to go to school there, which he didn't like. And then I thought to myself, you know, I've got 4 years to somehow get through college. And I was flipping burgers at Baker's Square there in South Holland. And I thought, I'm not doing this for the next 4 years. There's got to be a better way to get through school. He said, you know, those bellmen, the guys who carry up the luggage and the doorman, do you know how much money those guys make? And I said, you got to be kidding. He said, you know, think about it. He said, think if you go upstairs with people 50 times a day and they all give you $2 or $3 or $5. He says, you've had a pretty good night.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a physical job. You just have to be polite. There's not much to it, really. And I thought, that's perfect. You know,
I've known two bellmen. You're the third now. And I had the same story of all of them. My ex-radio partner and good friend, Lisa, her dad was a bellman for many years. And I had a friend in high school who did the same thing. And he worked at the McCormick Inn, I think it was, across from McCormick Place.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he would come back with roles. I'm like, dude, I'm in the wrong business, you know, because you sometimes you dismiss it. Oh, you're a glorified waiter or whatever,
sure.
You know, but you make some good bank on that.
Oh, man. And when you're, you know, in the top few hotels in the country, right there on the Magma by the water tower, you know, you're dealing with, we used to joke that these jobs are economy proof because the people that were staying there were not affected by the price of gasoline or anything. You know
right.
What I mean? And it was just, it was crazy at some points, you know, that we'd spend 3-4 hours and we'd leave with, you know, a few hundred dollars. And I remember how, you know, some of these guys were 50, 55, and people would almost take pity on them. Oh, the poor doorman's got to be out here for $5 an hour. I'm thinking the guy's got a boat on the lake. You know, this guy, don't feel sorry for this guy, okay? So it was that was the one of the best parts of it was the cash. And for a student to have the flexible hours, and then you're downtown. You know, I grew up in Hammond. The next thing I know, I'm in a 5-star hotel, you know, and Robert Plant pulls up or, you know, it's just like this. It was dreamy. It was an absolute dreamy thing. So mm-hmm. by my best friend being forced to go to school, you know, I thought, well, that's a great way to work my way through college. And that's what I did, you know.
Wow. You know, let's talk a little bit about Robert Plant. You mentioned that what hotel was it? Can you say, or would you rather not?
That's one thing I'm really careful about in the book, because I still work in the industry, and there are colleagues of mine that have written sort of real scandalous tell-all. I didn't want to do that.
Right.
I mean, a lot of us could do that. This book.
I imagine you see the ugly side.
There could be an equally sized book of all the terrible things I've encountered, right. But I didn't want to do that. That just seemed like something that people had tried. The challenge for this book was to write something that was entertaining and interesting and captivating, but still upbeat and uplifting and almost a welcoming to the industry rather than a, you know, because it's not all. You know, it's like anything else in life. You meet a lot of people that you like. You meet people that you don't. You meet people that have good days and bad. And so,
all right. Let's bring up Mr. Robert Plant here and listen to a little bit of his Big Log song. And we're going to find out what he was like. Big Log. Robert Plant, one of the great voices of rock and roll. Of course, with Led Zeppelin, doing a lot of stuff with Alison Krauss, and just doing a lot of the Americana music these days. And my guest is Louis Dybel. He's the author of 20 Years on the Gold Coast, and one of the many celebrities he met while working in Chicago's finest hotels was Mr. Plant. Are you surprised, before we get into what your in reactions were to him, are you surprised that he went from this rock star? Because you're from the era that followed Led Zeppelin, when he was huge as the ultimate rock star, that he's doing this Americana stuff now and refuses to go back to that. Do you find that surprising?
Yeah, I saw him do an interview recently within the last few months, and he was talking about how he thought it was very professional of David Bowie, say, or Prince, or these guys that had these huge albums that they could have continued to tour on, but they went into a completely different direction. And, you know, the fans came to see all the songs. And,
right.
You know, and I thought with a career as long as his, he's probably tried different things. I heard him say recently that on all of his solo albums, he'd always worked with a different team except for these last two Americana. I mean, that's pretty weird to constantly switch engineers and musicians and things. But he did that. But he kept them the same for this. Maybe he's just bored, you know? I mean, he started out as like a blues guy, and I think he was 17 at the time that Terry Reid was. And he was pretty young when that first record came out. So I guess I'm not surprised, because he is a real artist to me, you know, and he's someone that is not going to just live off the hits and, you know, and continue to produce music that's the same, even if it's what his fans may think they want.
Mm-hmm. You know, what was he like? What was the situation where you met him? At what era of his career? And what was he like? What were your expectations? And did he meet them or fail them?
He far exceeded them. You know, I would have expected and almost been okay with him just being a total, you know, I'm a diva, don't look at me. I mean, I liked him so much it would have been like, you know, we are not worthy kind of thing. You know, I was a huge fan. And he was literally the first celebrity that I had ever met. I was working midnights at the time, which means that I just started at the hotel. Pulled up and got out of the car, a couple people with him. Very cool. Very warm and welcoming. I was so shaken up, and I kept saying to myself, my friends are never going to believe this, you know? And I literally backed one of the guest cars into a cab, smashed it, you know?
Oh!
Could have been terminated. I remember him to this day looking back and smiling at me, and he knew it was that I was so freaked out to see him. But
he, so he knew he kind of caused the accident.
And he would tease me about it sometimes. You know, no cars today. Okay, you know, not exactly in that Southside accent that I have, but, you know. But he was really tall. We called him the tall, cool one from the line of the song. And it was in the late 80s, during, like, the Honey Drippers period, that he now seems to act like was not cool. But I thought it was pretty cool, you know. And I think a lot of people did. It was just another weird transition, like we talked about, where he had, you know, just went into this now, and then he was going into that now. And but he got to be such a regular of ours, because this is back in the late 80s. This was before the Peninsula and the Four Seasons and many of these, and the Trump Hotel and these. There was only a couple of really 4- and 5-star hotels, you know, the Park Hyatt, the Ritz. So we got to see him fairly regular, and it got to the beat to the point where I was surprised, because I had crashed a car upon excitement about, you know, meeting him. And then within a few months, it's like, oh, there's Robert again. You know, hey, how's it going, Ron? You know, giving us tickets to backstage passes, signing autographs.
So hitting that car actually endeared him to you, because he remembered you. Who can forget the guy that just smashed the car?
The dangerous guy. Don't let this guy drive me anywhere.
Wow, that's great. So so he was. Do you remember? Not necessarily Robert, but do you remember? Were there any exceptional tippers? I don't want to ask you the least ones, because I have a few of those that would come to the clubs and you'd think, oh my gosh, these guys are going to like throw some money. And they were the cheapest tippers. Our waitress would say, I'm not going to wait that guy, but he's famous. I don't care. He's giving me $1 for a tray of drinks. And I won't mention any names, because I never like to do the negative, but the positive. Who were the big tippers?
Michael Jordan was huge. Huge tipper, the biggest. He would just throw it around. His wife, even more. I mean, his wife would just throw hundreds around. Sinatra, everyone's heard the famous story of Sinatra that gave a doorman $300, got in his limo, drove about 10 feet and backed up, and he said, what's the biggest tip you ever got? And the doorman said, $300 from you last year. You know what I'm saying? He was a huge tipper. But I'd have to say I got the most money in my career from Jordan, because I also think it's because I happened to work at a hotel that his office was literally connected to on Michigan Avenue. So we would see him 2 or 3 times a week. It got to be routine. You know, it just got to be, oh, there's Michael. And, you know, they'd have – he's a famous gambler. You know what I'm
right.
saying? Famous gambler. And we would see him and Scottie Pippen and all of the, you know, the classic Bulls dynasty team would pull up in 5 very expensive vehicles, not wanting to get, you know, their cars parked. So we had to leave them in front of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go up there and play poker for hours and hours and come down. And you could always tell who had the better day by who tipped the most and whose mood was the best, you know. But he always really threw it around, really threw it around.
Now, one of the other artists that you have worked with, and there's many in this book, Springsteen, Chris Farley, you had an encounter with some of the Kennedys, Bono, which we're going to do in just a moment here. But tell me about the negative side of the celebrity issue. Was there any times that they are, and I don't name names, but that they were difficult to the point where it made your job like horrible?
Drew Barrymore.
Oh, I love her.
I love her, too, and I still do. But I was – and she wasn't nasty towards anyone particularly. But she was a huge – and probably still is a huge animal rights activist.
Mm-hmm.
And she happened to come to this hotel, and I followed her up and you know, to make sure that everything was kosher with her room. And she was just freaking out on her aide, you know, and saying she couldn't possibly stay here. I mean, I was – it was tense when I walked in there. My heart actually skipped a beat. I'm like, wow, this is the little girl from E.T., you know?
Yeah.
And this dude was shaking. And, you know, and she said, and apparently there was some little plastic sign on the desk that advertised for fur coats, as is in every hotel in the world.
Five-star hotels especially, people tend to wear furs.
On Michigan Avenue.
Yeah.
You know? So she just freaked out. So she did leave. And I have to say, though, and you know, when she came in and smiled at me, I was just like, wow, she really was mesmerizing. And to see her walk out immediately after the you know, the litany of and then she just walked out just like, a you know, hi, how are you? You know, just completely. But that one, I felt bad about that because I knew the hotel she was going into. I used to work at. They have the same exact advertisements on the desk. And I'm sure that her people gave them a heads up and they cleared it. Why they didn't do that for us, I don't know. But, I mean, that's what we do. Paul McCartney came into the Ritz and he and his wife,
famous
Linda.
Famous vegan.
Famous. We had to take out every piece of leather furniture in the hotel. He wouldn't even – we didn't
– in the whole hotel?
In the entire lobby. Any path that he was on, we could not have leather. In the room, anything at all. Anything with a face, I guess.
Wow.
You know? But that's what we do, you know. That's what we do in the business. It's exciting and fun, but There are days where it's just like, wow, you know. I mean, I've got a Barry Manilow story that would blow your mind.
Let's share it.
You know, he was famous for not sleeping well. And we had a suite at our hotel that was floor-to-ceiling windows, 2,500 square feet. We checked him in, everything okay, yeah. He said, I'm just going to need one thing. I'm going to need these windows aluminum foiled. And I said, you mean in the bedroom, Mr. Manilow? No, the entire suite. I need it. I can't have any daylight in here. I have to sleep. I said, no problem. You know, you can imagine how long that took, how many people it took. But that's the type of hoops that you just...
Maybe he was expecting aliens to communicate or something. I mean, we always hear that when you put the aluminum foil in the windows. Wow, that's bizarre. Why didn't he just check into a room that had less windows?
Well, that wouldn't have been the presidential suite, I guess, apparently. You know, he had to have the nicest suite, of course. Some of these people are very used to being treated special for a very long time.
You have your own
time.
Versions of the Brown M&M story, then, it sounds like.
You got it. One of my favorite bands.
Wow. That's pretty wild. Now you have one of the people in here that, again, the listeners may not know as well as some of these others we just mentioned. And of course, I'm talking about Ike, who is a good friend of yours, Ike Riley.
Yeah.
He's Chicago based.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he has performed a lot. His publicist is constantly saying, "Hey, Ike's back playing here and playing there," and an amazing guy. And sadly, not enough people know who he is, kind of like Terry Reid on the world stage.
Exactly.
Even in Chicago, a lot of people don't know Ike. Tell us about Ike Riley and tell us about your personal connection. And he's got his own chapter in the book. And we'll play a song from him.
Yeah, he does. You know, I wish I could spend an hour just talking about him. I met him the first day that I worked there, and we became friends. And he was just getting out of school and starting, you know, a band, and was playing all the local places like Martyrs and, you know, all the places downtown where you'd get maybe a couple hundred people in. But, I mean, long short, the strength of his personality, and we've been very good friends for a long time, you know, the strength of his personality really comes out in the lyrics. Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine is another.
He's a strong personality.
Libertyville boy.
Yeah.
You know, both from Libertyville. Marlon Brando, all those guys up there. Something in the Water up there in Libertyville. Farley spent some time up there. Farley and Riley, close friends, went to Marquette. Riley and Tom Morello. Tom Morello just started his own record label a couple years ago called Firebrand. Mm-hmm. And the first artist he signed, Ike Riley. Does a Rolling Stone interview about the new record label Firebrand. Who does he want to talk about? Ike Riley, you know. And, you know, Riley, I remember Riley begging me one time. He says, Lou, you got to let me out tonight. I know it's your turn to leave, but I got to go, you know. Joe Strummer's playing over at Shubas. And I'm like, get out of here. And he was a fanatic Clash fan. And I said, go ahead. So he, sure enough, meets, befriends Joe Strummer from the Clash. You know, ends up in the studio with him doing different things, collaborating. Mars Williams from the Psychedelic Furs, good friend of ours.
Wow.
Yeah, and Liquid Soul. All these guys.
Great horn man.
You know, one of the best. Another guy that's sober, clean and sober, you know. But I just couldn't believe, and he was a few years older than me, and I just couldn't believe, how does this guy know everyone? How does he know all these people? He and Chris Farley were best friends at Marquette. They're on the same rugby team, you know. And I'm just like, it was like an onion that just continued, the layers just continued to peel, and I'm just like, this guy's not real. You know, there's just too many. Great, great guy. And the personality that would make you literally, you know, I'd go home and my gut would hurt from laughing, you know. Just he was one of those. He was funny as Farley, in my view.
Mm. Let's play a song from Ike Riley. For those that may not be familiar with his music, this is a good one to start with. He's got several albums out, several great songs, but this one is one you may have heard on some radio stations and on some playlists. This is "Born on Fire," Chicago's own Ike Riley.
You came into the world the day that all the kings died. I felt the heat in your heart, saw the flames in your eyes. For 3 days and three nights, you didn't sleep or even tire. Yeah, you're gonna burn bright, 'cause you were born on fire.
seen you rage, and I've seen you blue. But that don't break my heart like when you look me in the eye and you ask me questions like, where we going when we die? And who you gonna love? And how you gonna live? And will you be a poor one? Or could I leave you rich? I can't leave you no money. I can't leave you no land. I can't leave you no faith. I lost a little I had, but I can leave you this truth. Hold on to hope and desire, and take your flames to the streets, 'cause you were born on fire.
Born on Fire, title track from the 2015 release on Firebrand Records, Rock Ridge. That is Ike Riley, The Assassination. That is the name of the group, The Ike Riley Assassination. But Ike Riley is the star of the band and the leader of the band and the founder of the band and the former bellman, along with Louis Dybel, who is my guest here on Midwest Beat, author of 20 Years on the Gold Coast. And how long did he work as a bellman before he decided, I'm going to just chase music full time?
About 8 years.
Okay. Had to kind of finance maybe his early albums.
No doubt about it. And you know, I remember when he, you know, his wife got pregnant, and that's when he, you know, was, well, the music's great, keep doing it, you know, but, you know, so he started to use some of the talent and skills of, you know, recording and started to do commercials for, like, Portillo's, and a lot of the things you've probably seen on TV and the voiceovers are through Diamond City, his company and stuff, and, you know, he doesn't advertise the jingles that he writes for kids to drink milk, but, you know, it pays the bills, you know what I mean?
A lot of famous folks have done jingles, you'd be surprised. You know, we've talked about a lot of the music guests, and we're going to talk about another one or two before we leave, but let's touch on some of the other folks. We did mention Michael Jordan being a great tipper, but you've worked with one of my personal childhood heroes, Ernie Banks. What was Ernie like?
That's a surreal thing, and that was one of the things that helped me to decide to write the book, because it was just such a full circle. I remember being a little kid going to Wrigley Field with my dad, and there must have been about 50 kids, you know, just screaming for autographs. And for 20 minutes, I must have just looked pathetic, because I just said, Dad, I'm never going to get one, and I just dropped my shoulders. And Jack Brickhouse, the famous and legendary, must have just felt sorry for me. Hand to God, stops the interview, picks me up over the railing, walks me into the dugout at Wrigley Field, sits me down next to Ernie Banks. I'm 7 years old, looking out at Wrigley Field from the, and Mr. Baseball sitting right next to me.
Wow.
Absolutely. My heart's beating, you know. And I'm so little that I almost don't appreciate it. I kind of want to go back to my dad because I'm scared. And my dad's like, no, just fine, you know. Go ahead. You know, and I got an autograph from him, and it was great. And then
do you still have it?
I still have it, both autographs.
Okay.
Because years later, I saw him at the hotel. Here's what a nice man Ernie Banks was. And I'm not kidding. There are people that act nice, and there are just people that really are wonderful. And I told him the whole story, and he was so nice that he actually pretended to remember me. Impossible, you don't remember.
Right.
But that's how sweet he was. He was like, oh, yeah, I remember. And I'm like, any chance of another autograph? You know? And I got another one. And then, of course, as fate would have it, my grandfather happened to be buddies of his just through building and commercial development downtown, Fred Peterman. A lot of pics of those guys together. So it was just... it was just a weird thing how everything just came full circle. I thought, you know, there's too many stories like this. When 100 people tell you you should write a book, you know, you mm-hmm. start to actually listen. When a couple people say, but when you start hearing it all the time and from everyone, it's like, you know what, I'm just going to go ahead and write it then, you know.
Very good. I remember meeting Ernie briefly. He stopped at Miner Dunn in Highland.
Yeah.
Mickey Mantle stopped there, and Farmer Brown, the wrestler, stopped there, and Sly and the Family Stone stopped there while I was working. But nobody really bothered Ernie. I just remember him being very cordial to the waitress and everything, tipped well.
Yeah.
And we were all afraid. You know, you're afraid to walk up to someone like that because what if they're not nice and you're crushed.
That's true. And I said that, and that's exactly what I said in the book, too, is that, you know, some people don't want to meet their heroes because if they're not as nice as they thought, then they would have a different impression. But I've actually met people that said, I just don't want to meet him because if he's a jerk, then it's going to ruin my whole image of him, you know.
Right.
That doesn't work for me, you know.
Right, right. I've met a few of those, and it does change your skew on them.
It does.
I mean, there was one in particular, I won't mention him, but he was a big star, and I was so put off by his behavior, not necessarily towards me, but just his behavior, that I stopped playing his records. I'm like, wow. Okay.
I've got one of those, and I'm wondering if it's the same guy. We'll
talk
after
that. We'll do that off air, yeah. Ernie, I mean, in the end, I guess he wasn't willing to sign autographs. They said he'd show up, and they said, oh, no, he wouldn't sign autographs the last couple of years of his life. Now, I don't know if that was fact or fiction, but I had heard that from a couple of people that approached him, and he had someone that was usually with him and says, no, he's not signing today.
That may have been due to onset of Alzheimer's. You know, it's really hard to sign. I remember I talk about Muhammad Ali in that book, and I asked him to sign an autograph for me, and it took him, and I'm not exaggerating, it was before the public really knew how bad it was. It probably took him 3 minutes to sign. I was just sitting there, like, sweating, like, what an ass am I, you know?
Yeah.
I felt awful. His wife's looking at me, like, and I'm just like, wow. And then she came and pulled out of her purse pre-signed autographs. She had a stack of them so that he wouldn't have to stop like that and spend 4 minutes. And she gave me a few of the little cards with them. And I felt awful about it, you know. But had I known, I would have never troubled him, you know. And he was so cool anyway, you know. He's huge. People don't realize how big that guy was. His shoulder, he looked like a refrigerator. You know, he put up his fist to me, you know, like in a mock boxing. They look like canned hams, man. I mean,
wow.
I wouldn't have gotten in the ring with that guy for all the whiskey in Ireland.
Muhammad Ali. So, we just lost him recently, Ernie Banks. I mean, you've met some of the great folks, Harry Carey, that are no longer with us. Another one that is one of those people that I never would have had the opportunity to meet, but that I would have been afraid to meet only because of being disillusioned, and that is Elizabeth Taylor, the most beautiful woman in film, in my opinion. Mm. I still carry a torch for her. I love her from when she was a child star with the horses and, you know, National Velvet on up to Cleopatra. In fact, I have a life mask of her from Cleopatra.
Oh, wow.
What was she like?
Stunning. You know, she went through so many phases in her life, as you probably know, being a fan, you know. This was during that period that she had met the carpenter guy that she married. I forget his name now, but everyone was shocked that the queen of Hollywood married this.
Marrying a blue-collar guy.
Blue-collar working guy. That was that era. And she was older, and she, I don't know if you remember the black and white Richard Burton, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know? That's the kind of attitude that she seemed to come in with, which was surprising. She was a complicated person, but she was so close to me. And I always joke, I have to be careful because my wife's here. But, you know, there was such a crowd, and she nestled so close to me that I, you know, there was a little bit of intimacy there. And I thought, well, that was nice, you know. And then, you know, and then she went up to her room, and our, you know, our chef concierge was friends of hers, and, you know, doting over her. And, you know, you could hardly get near her. And poor Larry David, that was his name, Larry David. You know, he's just kind of sitting. I was talking more to him, you know, than her, because she's surrounded getting flowers. You know, it always shocked me that the richest, most famous people never pay for anything. Mm-hmm. They didn't pay for the hotel. They don't pay for I just thought, well, maybe that's how they got rich, or stay rich.
Stay rich.
Because that room was $2,500 a night.
Wow.
You know, so. But she was cool. She was really relaxed, almost like, you know, hey, Swampy, kind of, you know what I mean?
As pretty in real life as we see her?
You know, I should be careful. I should say that had she wanted to be, she certainly could have been. She must have just gotten off a long flight and ride. She looked like her character in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Okay.
She really did. And I don't know, you know, And I'm sure that that was unusual, and heaven, you know, who am I to judge her? She'd probably be one of the most attractive people that ever lived. But she may have not been looking her absolute best that particular day. And okay. She just got out of rehab.
Ah, okay. Mel Gibson, when was that? Now, the reason I ask is we were doing something with a German teen band. My daughter was a teen writer, and we were at the commissary at, what was that talk show? It was a lady talk show host. I can't think of her name. And anyway, we're at the commissary at the network, and we're sitting there, and it was between lunch and dinner, and who happens to be sitting next to us with a glass partition is Mel Gibson.
Oh, wow.
And I remember my family, my daughter in particular, wanting to go get an autograph. And I was like, he's having lunch, you know? And then some lady came in that looked like they were talking business. We can't interrupt them. It's just not the way it's done. Mm. So we never did get a chance to say hello to him, but he just seemed very nice to the waitress, very nice to the bartender that was there. They seemed to tip very big. And was he a nice guy? You hear so many negative stories about Mel Gibson. This was before all of that happened.
Well before. He was still young. It was like when Lethal Weapon was just blowing up.
Right.
So, and he was with Danny Glover, who is probably the single nicest celebrity that you'll ever meet in your life, I would imagine. I mean, he just seemed like a gentle soul and just really approachable. Mel was like almost like his character in Lethal Weapon. It was almost like he was in character, you know, just hyper and joking around. But everyone loved him. You know, you talked about how you're not supposed to contact these guys, and they all gave us the usual, you know, don't ask for autographs. Mel Gibson's coming in, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, everyone just kind of looked at each other like, yeah, right. You know, you can't fire everyone. You know, all yeah. of the staff just kind of surrounded him and talked to him. And he was really cool. He came in late, really approachable, just sat there and BS'd with us, and shockingly, you know. And then it just goes back to the whole Ringo Starr thing where, you know, 10 years later, he's going on these bizarre anti-Semitic rants, you know. It's the same guy.
Right.
You know.
We've got a song we're going to play now. It's a song that is important to you. You mentioned in the book. We're going to start off with this. We're going to talk about your encounter with these very famous rock and rollers. We're going to go back to the Emerald Isle of music with you two in Red Hill Mining Town.
The blood runs thin. See faces frozen still.
Hey! to the sky. We stoop so low to reach so high. A link is lost, a chain undone. We wait all day for night to come, and it comes like a hunted child.
Hill Mining Town. Giving you the full song there because that's one of those acts and one of those songs you just don't edit down. Good stuff. And my guest is Louis Dybel. His book is 20 Years on the Gold Coast, and there is a chapter about you too. And Louis, in that you mention Red Hill Town and Heartland as being two of your favorite U2 songs and songs that still give you chills. And I could tell you were enjoying it here in the studio. What is it about that song? And then we'll talk about your encounter with Bono and the Edge.
I remember liking U2 when they were really not quite famous, like early 80s, and thinking, wow, wouldn't it be cool if a band like this, a fresh band, could come out and you know, it wouldn't just have to be the death metal stuff, which is fine. But, I mean, I just thought that it was hopeful and uplifting, a little more poetic. And let's face it, I mean, when you listen to a U2 song, you know, it's the harmony is almost angelic. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just something. I thought it was cool. How many guys could put an Irish fiddle in a rock song and still be cool?
Right.
It was different.
Now, you mentioned, you talk about the political side of Bono. And you're mentioning that it was kind of awe-inspiring to see this guy walk in. I mean, given the fact he was the Time Magazine Person of the Year, he had worked with all these different causes, world hunger, AIDS, and here he was, you know, face-to-face basically with you in your hotel.
And that was another inspiration to write it, because I went to Ireland. It was my first time in Europe, and flew into London. You know, this was March of, I think, 94. And flew into London and had a transfer flight from London into Dublin, which is only 20 minutes. During the time that it took my plane to leave the tarmac in London and the 20 minutes in Ireland, the IRA had bombed Heathrow Airport. It was the first time the IRA had bombed mainland England in over 25 years. Had that plane been delayed, I would probably have still been on the runway. And I just, you know, that was my introduction to Ireland. I land and I've got the trench coat on and I look like an American and there's cops everywhere. I'm just thinking, wow, I'm on vacation, guys, you know. So, and I have no place to stay, so I get in a cab and I say, where's a good place to stay? They say, well, stay at the Clarence. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why? And they said, do you know who owns it, don't you? And I said, no, Bono owns it. U2 owns it. And I said, you got to be kidding. So U2 owns this hotel called the Clarence in Dublin, Ireland, right on the Guinness River. I check in, and it's true about the Irish. Marlon Brando, Clinton, Matthew Broderick, they all buy property in Ireland because it's the one country they can go in the Western world and not be mobbed. It's something about the Irish culture and temperament where they just don't care about celebrity. My grandparents were from Clare, and I remember my grandpa always saying, you know, he puts his pants on the same way I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, if Bono walked down the street in Chicago, he'd be mobbed and torn apart. In Dublin, they literally just kind of looked at him like, oh, there he is then, you know. So they're literally hanging out in the bar. In the hotel they own, I'm sitting there, the Edge walks in, you know, and I'm ready to just fall off my chair naturally. And all the Irish people I'm with are like, oh, there he is. And it's like, what? You know? So that was interesting to see them in their own element, and sitting there at a big table and, you know, the edges having a drink and smoking a cigarette. And no one cares, you know, except for me, of course. And I'm trying not to be, like, gushing with enthusiasm. So I did meet him there. And I think the reason I got to talk to him here was years later when I saw him at the hotel. And he came out and I said, really enjoyed your place at the Clarence. And that caught his attention, you know, and he stopped and shook my hand and all of that. So that was really cool. He had a crowd of kids, probably 100 deep, waiting outside the hotel to meet him. And like most celebrities, they would sneak out the back. He literally called Domino's and sent like 50 pizzas to these kids. And, you know, he was sending food to these kids. You know, he's so cool. And so we had a tight line for him to leave the hotel and get into a limo. And, of course, he broke the line, went out to the kids. He's 20 minutes late for the show because he's signing every autograph, blows off the limo, jumps in a cab, and goes to the show. I like this guy. You know, I like this guy. So that was neat to be able to catch his attention on the way out as someone that had known Dublin and stayed in his hotel. And
is he an active hoteler or just an owner? I mean, you come from the industry. He owns a hotel. It's very famous. Did you bond in any way or have any connection on that level?
I got to be honest. I think they had made so much money that they had to find things to do with it other than just give it to the government. And I think they were just investments. He certainly hung out there. But something tells me he probably wasn't screaming at the bellman for not being quick enough or whatever it is. You know, he didn't seem active, although he was in and out of the administrative offices and stuff. But God knows. I doubt he was busting anyone's chops about the fork knife being too heavy or something.
Slip him a resume while you were there saying, hey, you know what? I like Ireland. I wouldn't mind running your hotel.
No, Debbie, my wife, would never have moved to Ireland.
you talk about when you met him about how some of the politicians were shocked that he actually knew his topics.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if people recall, but he gave extensive testimony before congressional committees. His cause was trying to erase the third world debt. The third world had gotten into such serious debt to the first world. There was no possible way to repay it. It's like someone that makes, you know, 50 grand a year trying to pay a $1 million mortgage. I mean, there's just no way to pay it. And he thought, well, are we going to keep them as indentured servants forever, or can we start to erase and renegotiate this debt? And that was his cause. And, you know, you could see the snarky senators just being like, you know, rolling their eyes that they had to sit there with
Here's
this rock star.
Celebrity, you know.
But he wasn't just another celebrity. I mean, his knowledge of the issues, the intimate detail he had of the issues, that you saw them all leave that meeting like shocked and like, wow. You know, and he articulated pretty simple solutions to the problems, you know. So I loved that. And I loved, like, when Eddie Vedder would go up against, you know, Ticketmaster. And so these are real rock guys that aren't just performing. They're actually, you know, they're bringing it,
right?
You know.
They remember what it's like to be a human being.
Yeah, how about it?
Wow. Are there any others that really stand out in that capacity that you think give back in a way that maybe people don't realize?
Tom Hanks. It's funny how that ties in. The gentleman that I told you that I got the job in the hotel because his mom was forcing him to get out of college.
It wasn't Tom Hanks.
No. Although it's funny because Tom Hanks was a bellman. And through a long series of events, he's a great guy, and he's got a production studio in Chicago. But I remember Tom Hanks particularly when I checked him out. He was joking with me all the way down the elevator to the point where I was laughing hysterically, and I really felt like I was just in a room with a bunch of guys I had known my whole life. And he was a huge star by then. And I remember checking him out. And one of the funniest stories in that book that I think is we were watching him later on Carson, the old Carson show. And you remember how Carson would have his first guest, and then when he was done, you would move him down. But you would still be on TV. So he had done his segment. Billie Jean King was there. And Johnny says, do you two know each other? And he says yes, and she says no. And everyone kind of just pauses and laughs a minute. And he reminded her that he had been a bellman for her when he was, you know, just a kid and carried her luggage, and that she stiffed him. Just embarrassed, called her out on national TV. You know? Can you imagine how we just fell out? I mean, we just fell out. So that kind of fun stuff. You know, I compare myself to I always call myself the Forrest Gump of the hotel business, the kind of fly on the wall that really had no reason to be there, but forever it has a snapshot memory of all these things. So he was great, and I know he does a lot of things without calling, you know, 100 cameras around.
Another one that has a lot of cameras on him right now is Bill Cosby. Mm. And he is mentioned in your book.
Yeah.
And you had encountered him. What was your perspective of him?
I grew up as a little kid watching The Cosby Show, thinking it was the coolest thing that they had him talk and Fat Albert, and then they would have the cartoon always. You know, this was back in the 70s. I try to tell my kids, there were no VCRs. There were no cell phones. I mean, there was Saturday morning cartoons.
Right.
If a movie left the theater, you might see a chopped up version of it 3 years later on TV. It wasn't like it is now. So that was a big deal. Star Wars in 1976 was a big deal to kids because there weren't 1,000 distractions. So I remember being shocked because he stayed with us, and repeatedly I would bring him things and do things and spent time alone with him, chatting with him. And I thought, what a great guy. And I would come home and tell my wife and kids, and just charming and funny and just what you'd expect him to really be. And then you start hearing these things. And at first you're just, no one believed it.
Right.
No one believed it.
But there's just too much.
Where there's that much smoke, there's some fire.
Right.
But I was shocked at what a true sociopath he must be to have been able to charm the entire world.
All those years.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that was kind of shocking to me. I felt bad that I didn't have more intuition than that. Then I realized he fooled everybody.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time. One last comment, and we got to keep it real quick. Bruce Springsteen is in your book. Nice guy, not nice guy. What's your take on him?
Wonderful guy. Would have stayed for another 10 hours if there were more autographs to be signed.
Wow.
I do want to say one thing. The reason I'm here, of course, is to promote my book signing tomorrow at Miles Books in Highland from 11:30 to 2:30. This is my first book signing in Highland with Miles Books. You can look him up on the web.
On Jewett Street.
On Jewett Street. Great guy. Independent bookstore, which I'm a huge supporter of. And he's been wonderful to me, and we expect a heck of a turnout tomorrow. That's 11:30 to 2:30.
All right. My guest has been Louis Dybel, 20 years on the Gold Coast, Miles Books tomorrow. What time?
11:30 to 2:30.
All right. In Highland on Jewett Street. Thank you for listening. We're going to leave you with The Boss. We're all born to run right out of the studio. Adios, everybody. Have a good day.